WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for June the 3rd, 2018. Yes, the first Sunday of June. Welcome to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we take you from City Hall to Springfield and all the way out to Washington, D.C. So, time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee. We'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. Well, kind of a unusual situation here, Mr. Schwann, who's right across from me here in the Chokey Studio.
As opposed to being upstairs with Andy, who's all by himself.
All by myself.
Things are going bump in the morning up
here. You're probably having the time of your life up there right now.
It actually does look like the Twilight Zone in the newsroom, where you walk in and it's vacant and there's stuff strewn all over.
There's paper everywhere.
How does it look any different than any time I've ever seen it?
Well, there's nobody in it. That's why.
There's no equipment and there's nobody else in there.
Uh-huh. Well, and of course, this is all part of our eventual move out of historic Tribune Tower, both WGN Radio moving out of Tribune Tower, Chicago Tribune, same as well. So a lot of packing going on.
We're in transit.
That's a good way to put it. I can think of some other words I could use here, believe me.
Oh, yeah.
But it's kind of, you know. Now, I spent my first 10 years at the Tribune largely down in Springfield, so I only have 20 years of accumulated garbage. Okay. And
the other 10 is still in Springfield?
Yes. where it belongs. But you find all of these different weird things that you kind of forgot, you know, they're in drawers and things.
Sure. Well, that's just like a move at home when you're, you know, you move your place from one to another, you find things that you forgot about.
Well, so even like this morning when I came in and I was just rummaging through some stuff to help clean up, I find a whole stack of Rod Blagojevich videotape of the commercials that he ran in his campaign.
Really?
Videotapes. I can't get rid of those.
No.
I mean, in case you know, his name's been in the news lately.
Yeah, I think so.
We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that later. So, I mean, there's things like that. All of my lanyards. From
all of them?
From the various campaigns, which, well, I had them hanging, you know, kind of in the cubicle, which apparently we're not having cubicles at the newspaper anymore when we make our move. Workstations is the polite word for it.
I thought you'd have a private office with your name on the door. And
where did you ever come up with that idea?
I just assumed.
I've got my own private office right now.
Well, yeah, see, Andy may be the only one that doesn't move.
Oh,
he's going to like it so much
Andy
up there.
Andy Mazur, do not
I'm
disturb.
I'm just staying right here.
Yeah, wait till you find out when the bathrooms are disconnected.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
I already did.
Well, I mean, you found a couple of interesting things you were showing me this morning.
Well, actually, the finds that I had took place at another move when my father was moving
right
at the end of the year last year to his new location. I kind of remembered that I had these and then forgot about them, but we were cleaning out some files in a chest of drawers, and I found the very last editions of the Chicago Daily News and Chicago Today, the very last ones.
But it's the Daily News. It's the real news.
Yeah,
because
with Mike Royko's final column for the Daily News on there. And I guess he went to the Sun-Times after that.
Right. So Long, Chicago.
So Long, Chicago.
That's the headline.
1978. And, well, if anybody is listening from Highland High School, a few friends of mine decided that we were going to be sick one day.
Senior ditch day.
Yeah, and came here and thought we'd spend the day, you know, being Mr. Cool in Chicago. And it just so happened that was the day after or so, the the shutdown of the Daily News. We went over there, and they were selling the final editions in a room off the lobby of the old building, like Sun-Times and the Daily News.
Like everything change
everything
happens.
Everything has changed. That building's not even there anymore.
Correct. Right, right.
There's another building in its place.
Yeah, and we won't go there on that one.
A large building in its place.
Where its source is known as fake news over there. I guess is the right way to put that. So, yeah, so all kinds of
you find things
going on.
Like this.
Yes.
You know, sure. I also found things from Cub Scouts that I completely forgot.
Cub Scouts? did you get merit badges, too?
Mm-hmm.
How many merit badges did you get?
They only gave me one.
What was that?
I don't remember.
First aid?
First aid, yeah, right. I put a Band-Aid around my finger, and that was about
did you find your Pinewood Derby car?
You know, the Pinewood Derby car might be somewhere, Andy. I was in the Pinewood Derby.
Me too.
Those were fun. You know,
yeah. Never made it in Cub Scouts.
Never
got,
did.
Got Boy Scouts, but
yeah.
Not Cub Scouts.
Yeah. Did you put decals on yours, Andy?
I painted mine. Mine was red with white racing stripes.
I had a blue one with a decal, kind of a racing stripe on it. Yeah.
And did you have like some secret oil that you used to get the wheels to spin faster on those things?
Right. Graphite.
Competition was intense.
Graphite for the wheels.
Uh-huh.
The competition was intense.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. Yeah. That was a real honor to, you know, to win that in the troop.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But graphite, the secret.
The graphite would work.
Yes, it was.
So, yeah, the Pinewood Derby car is probably somewhere. But I had a scrapbook of things. I found a scrapbook from a trip to Washington, D.C. that we took when I was 7 or 8.
Wow.
1964.
And that's all it took to say I never want to come back to this town ever again. Indoctrinated at an early age. Very good, very good. Boy. But
you're right, though. You find all kinds of things.
Yeah.
I can't believe you have all your lanyards.
Well, because I would just, you know, hang them up on the, you know, on the wall in the cubicle. And so I think I've got a new home coming for them. I'll let you know when I have that ready to announce.
Okay.
But I guess I may have a relocation place where you could actually see them.
Okay, as I say, you need a trophy case, your name on the door.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that ain't going to happen. Well, another great Stanley Cup game last night, even though my Vegas team fell short. And they just looked like they didn't have it going, Andy.
No, and you know Washington had so much to play for. That was their first home game in 19 years in the Stanley Cup final, and it was their first ever win in the Stanley Cup final, especially at home. And they were swept by Detroit the first time they got in, and they were ready to roll. And you know when you get that guy that's not supposed to play that does play. Evgeny Kuznetsov, he's the one that scored the game-winning goal.
Doesn't it always work that way?
It always does.
And you know, after as you said, the first game in Washington, after two games in Vegas with all of the trappings of Vegas and the pregame show and everything, and how does Washington respond?
Pat Sajak
doing the team lineups with the Wheel of Fortune type letters on the scoreboard. And apparently misspelling several players' names in the process on the scoreboard.
Nice.
Yeah, so Pat Sajak, who knew that he would be the secret to the Caps' first home win?
Yeah, he may be invited back tomorrow.
I wouldn't be surprised. You know how superstitious
yes,
everybody is.
Yes, they are.
I would not be surprised. And then, of course, tonight we've got the NBA final game 2.
Yeah, let's see if J.R. Smith understands that when the score is tied, you're not leading.
If he can count?
Yeah, that was really strange. I mean, I've seen it happen in college games before, and you can understand that college kids get a little bogged down with things.
Well, they get rattled.
You give them a little bit of an excuse because they're in college. But J.R. Smith, if you didn't see it or didn't hear about it, the free throw missed in a tie game late in the fourth quarter, and instead of going right back up or getting it to a shooter, he dribbled the ball back out towards half court, thinking that they won the game.
4.7 seconds left, and he spent 3.5 seconds dribbling it away from the basket.
Much to the big chagrin of LeBron James, who had both arms extended as to say, what the?
He was pointing at the basket. It's like you're going the wrong way.
He's like, what are you doing?
And so then he first, J.R. Smith acknowledges that he thought they were winning.
Right.
Then he later says that he knew it was tied.
Yeah, he doesn't really know.
And now, well, that's what that's the third part. Now, just, I don't know if it was yesterday or this morning where he says, I don't know what I was thinking.
Yeah, you know, I think he's in his third stage of denial there, whatever that is. But yeah, he was, you know, obviously there were some pretty funny things on the internet. Funny if you're not J.R. Smith. Funny things on the internet. These guys decided that they were going to really make fun of it. One guy starts taking they reenact the free throw. He dribbles the ball off the playground. They show him dribbling down a highway. It's hilarious what people will do. But obviously, it's not funny if you're J.R. Smith.
No.
Or the Cavaliers.
No. But we'll see what game two brings tonight.
Correct.
Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy has the latest sports. Producer Cassara's here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. On Twitter at @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is helping to find the packing tape. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Some interesting news in the New York Times this morning. The Times obtained a 20-page letter from President Trump's lawyers to Robert Mueller, the special counsel, and basically the finding of the president's lawyers and the strategy that they've been adopting for months is that there is no question that Mueller can ask about President Trump obstructing justice because President Trump is the chief law enforcement officer of the nation and has the power to terminate investigations. So, therefore, and also has the power to pardon. So, therefore, you cannot find Donald Trump, you can't accuse him or find him any evidence that he can be obstructing justice because, as president, you can't obstruct justice. Very novel kind of legal theory there. Much of the national talk last week with the president also had a decided Illinois angle when the president told reporters aboard Air Force One last week that he was considering commuting disgraced and imprisoned former Governor Rod Blagojevich's prison sentence. Trump said that 18 years was too much. Of course, Blagojevich was sentenced to 14 years. And Trump said Blagojevich did what other politicians all do, except he didn't. But on Fox News, the president's favorite channel, Patty Blagojevich, the former governor's wife, welcomed the news, berated President Obama, whose seat Blagojevich tried to sell, and praised Donald Trump as compassionate. Here's Patty Blagojevich.
He was, and we are all so grateful that the president is thinking of us in this way. But it's been such a long road for us, and we've been so disappointed so many times before, you know, by the court twice, by the president of our own party, we were disappointed by him. So it's hard to even hope that our deal might be ending soon. But, you know, we know that President Trump is a kind man, and he's compassionate. He's always been kind to my family. He knows how important it is that my husband gets home to be a father to our daughters, that we can't help, you know, to be hopeful.
So let's look at some things here. Patrick Fitzgerald, who prosecuted Blagojevich, is close to James Comey, the fired FBI director, and Robert Mueller, who's leading the special investigation. Patty Blagojevich was asked if her husband fit into a pattern that Trump alleges is of the deep state government and abuse. Here's more of Patty Blagojevich on Fox News.
I see that. I see that these same people that did this to my family, these same people that, you know, secretly taped us and twisted the facts and perverted the law that ended up my husband in jail, you know, these same people are trying to do the same thing that they did to my husband, just on a much larger scale. Mm-hmm. You know, they were emboldened. They took down a governor, and now they've got their sights much higher.
So the twisted facts, including the fact that Blagojevich was convicted of trying to shake down a children's hospital for political contributions in exchange for state funding, tried to shake down a racetrack industry in exchange for campaign contributions, and that doesn't even include the attempt to try to enrich himself by looking for a job that political allies might be able to give him a much better job than governor, because he was already bored with that. And then, you know, there's that thing about it's a bleeping golden, the U.S. Senate seat of Barack Obama, and he's not just going to give it away. So that's Rod Blagojevich. He's supposed to get out in 2024. Now we have the president talking about it, and oh, let's not forget that Blagojevich also appeared on Celebrity Apprentice, too. So there's a TV connection there. Also, in the same breath, talks about pardoning Martha Stewart, who, oh, yeah, she had a female version of Celebrity Apprentice that was under the auspices of the Trump organization. Yeah, you got those kinds of things going. So, in Nashville last week, the president told a rally of supporters that his 2016 presidential campaign was infiltrated by this deep state, by Justice Department and FBI officials working for his opponents.
So how do you like the fact they had people infiltrating our campaign? Can you imagine? Can you imagine? Can you imagine? People infiltrating our campaign. Is there anybody in this big, beautiful arena right now that's infiltrating our campaign? Would you please raise your hand? That would take courage, huh? Now, look, you take a look at what's going on. Never in the history of our country has something taken place like took place during this election.
That's his version of it. We'll have other people's version of what took place, including from the head of the House Oversight Committee. We'll have that coming up. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower, historic Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue, doing the show here for the last couple of times. But what a beautiful Sunday morning. Just you couldn't ask for better than this.
It's about time.
Yes, it is, really.
It is.
Well, I mean, when you look at even the end of the week, this past week, you had to have a jacket here downtown.
Sure did.
I mean, if you didn't have a jacket, you go 5 miles inland, you know, and it's 15 mm-hmm. degrees warmer.
Yeah. And there was actually a temperature drop, I think.
Yes.
It was Friday morning. It was fine outside about 6 o'clock, 6:30 Friday morning. But by 10:30, it was noticeably cooler.
About 15 degrees
Absolutely.
Cooler it
yeah.
dropped. It was
yeah.
The wind moving,
right.
The pressure system moving down the lake,
yeah.
and the wind blowing off
my,
the lake.
My car thermometer said 58 or 59, and then I looked at my calendar on my phone to see if we were in October.
Well, I actually thought the way the winds were blowing, too, there would have been a wind chill.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, you're not far wrong.
Because I think at times it was probably like 48 degrees.
It was rough.
Well, we're continuing our spin through national politics, and I mentioned after that cut of President Trump saying about how his campaign was infiltrated. He believes that, but Trey Gowdy, the South Carolina congressman, the Republican who chairs the House Oversight Committee, Gowdy says he's seen the Justice Department and FBI information about a confidential informant, and the Republican congressman was on CBS and says the FBI wasn't spying on Trump's campaign.
When the FBI comes into contact with information about what a foreign government may be doing in our election cycle, I think they have an obligation to run it out. I think the FBI, if they were at the table this morning, they would tell you Russia was the target and Russia's intentions toward our country were the target. The fact that two people who were loosely connected with the Trump campaign may have been involved. involved doesn't diminish the fact that Russia was the target and not the campaign.
That's Trey Gowdy. Well, we're going to switch gears here and talk about the end of the legislative session in Springfield. And joining me now on the phone is a good friend of the program, Brian Mackey. He's the State House correspondent for NPR Illinois and WUIS-FM in Springfield. Brian, good morning.
Good morning, Rick. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining me this morning. I know it's been a hectic week in Springfield last week.
I'm just beginning to catch up with all the sleep that I missed.
and then I had to wake you up, right?
Well, yeah.
I'm terribly sorry. Well, so I have a story in with my colleague Monique Garcia in the Tribune this morning, where I just found it, you know, only in Illinois in a deep, heavy, controversial election year, could you find a legislative session that ended with a kind of sense, at least a touch of normalcy, by adopting a budget?
Yeah, I mean, it was unsettling. Some people actually said that. State Senator Toy Hutchinson was commenting during the debate on the budget how strange it felt after the last few years of just constant bitter political fighting. And you know, one of the metaphors that we hear a lot in Springfield is Charlie Brown's Lucy in the football, right?
Right.
We think we were coming close to an agreement, and then it would get yanked away at the last minute, and Charlie Brown ends up flat on his back. And so it was an unusual feeling to have this sort of quiet resolution to the session.
Well, you got to think that ultimately, I mean, there's a variety of factors here, but ultimately the fact that we went through that more than two-year budget impasse, which we're going to be feeling the effects of that for years, if not decades to come, but that and constituent anger, the lack of funding for some social service safety net agencies, what it did to higher education in the state, no one wanted to even broach that going into the election because nobody would win.
Yeah, that seemed to be the case. I really think there were two sort of things you can look at as the turning points on why we got a deal this year so easily. One was how the impasse ended last summer. This was in July. There were legislature work for more than 2 weeks straight through the 4th of July holiday, and ultimately, they decided to raise taxes. And so that means there's a lot more money flowing into the state's coffers, and spending money is always easier to do for politicians than taking money from, you know, taking more
no
money
one likes to cut.
From their constituents. So, you know, because the state had so much more money to spend, it was easier to get to a deal, right? Everybody's happy to be able, well, not everybody, but most people seem happy to be able to just kind of move along with that. The other thing that's different is Governor Rauner, I think, is not feared the way he was in the State House, right? There was the way he was sort of rolled on that, the way the budget passed last year. There was staff chaos in his administration. He went through, basically, he fired his staff, then brought in this other staff from a conservative think tank, and then pretty shortly after that got rid of them and brought in yet a third round of staff. He signed some bills that particularly Republicans didn't like, one dealing with abortion, another one dealing with immigration issues. And then finally, he barely won his primary against State Representative Jeannie Ives. He only won by 3 percentage points. And so I think he is just not feared the way he was, and he seems to have been his administration participated in these negotiations, but my understanding is he was not an active, at least not an in-person participant in these negotiations.
Yeah, I think when you look back to last year where you had a group of Republicans that crossed lines to join with Democrats to override the governor's veto of the budget, to override his veto of the tax increase, and knowing coming off of a very divisive primary campaign, and knowing that those people that crossed over him the last time were probably there, you know, to do it again if necessary, that kind of changed the dynamic in Springfield as far as the governor, who of course was the primary source of funding a lot of their campaigns.
Yeah, that's right, and still is, really. I mean, the Illinois Republican Party is the, you know, to the extent that it's a force in politics today, it owes a lot of that to him for his funding. He still, you know, is very tight with the chair. It's his chairman still.
Right.
There was a fight about that this year. Yeah, so, I mean, he is still a force. He still has a lot of money to spend, but there just doesn't seem to be the fear of crossing him that there was in the past.
The you touched on the fact about, you know, with that tax increase, there is more revenue and there's a better ability to fund things. But I'm curious on a political level, because, you know, for months, if not longer, we had the governor saying about how he was going to roll back this Madigan 32% income tax increase. And now, you know, as expected tomorrow when he signs this budget, he's basically accepting that 32% income tax increase.
Yeah, I mean, that I think that cognitive dissonance is not something that would be unusual in a politician, and certainly not with Governor Rauner, and I think we're probably going to still continue hearing that. Now, we're told that the statement after the budget came out was he's going to take action to enact it, which is not quite the same thing as signing it. One imagines it leaves open the possibility of using a reduction veto. You know, the governor has unique and specific powers in Illinois where he can reduce amounts in budgets. The rest of the budget would go into effect, but those individual lines could be cut. I don't think we know yet what he's going to do with that. As you said, him having this money to spend, and not only is he seemingly going to agree to spend it, his own introduced budget spent this money from the tax increase. So it's one thing to be able to say, I want to cut your taxes, which I think people are still going to hear a lot of on the campaign trail, but it's another thing to actually do it. And I think that's one of the lessons we learned in the budget impasse, is how much money that state government spends can't be cut, really, effectively.
Right.
Because of court orders, you know, the state has obligations to people on the Medicaid program, and there's just, you cannot cut as much as people think.
No, and I mean, when you look at this budget, $38.5 billion, and you know, even though everybody walked away singing kumbaya, they talked, oh, you know, it's a balanced budget, there's no tax increase, that was the only conditions that the governor had, and that also was a unique aspect of this budget negotiation, because in the past the governor had always attached some provisions, non-budget related provisions to it, like things that would weaken organized labor or civil trial attorneys, traditional allies in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, this is the so-called turnaround agenda, and that's really what drove the two-year budget impasse. He wanted these things that were not related to the budget, and the Democrats that control the legislature, those things were anathema to what they stand for, and so that's where we stood for 2 years. But this year, as you said, he dropped, or he at least did not, you know, push those demands in relation to saying, you know, give me these things and only then will I agree to the budget. And that was certainly made things easier. You know, one imagines this is a fairly status quo budget. It doesn't do a lot of exciting new things.
Kind of a maintenance budget is kind of
I look at it. There's nothing real creative about, I mean, you know, look, I don't want to undercut the idea of getting a deal. That is an achievement in Illinois these days, and based on our low bar of the last few years. But this is, you want to imagine, this is a budget we could have had a few years ago had not the governor had these demands, had not, when the Democrats raised taxes back at the beginning of this decade, they made the decision to make it a temporary tax increase. If they'd have just made it permanent back then we never would have been in this position, and because there was that automatic tax cut that was scheduled to take place just as Governor Rauner came into office, he had all this leverage to be able to demand those non-budget items. In terms of, you know, in order to, so that the state could rebalance its books. But obviously things didn't work out that way.
They sure didn't. We're speaking with Brian Mackey, State House correspondent with NPR Illinois and WUIS-FM in Springfield. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Pearson here. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. Joining me on the phone from Springfield is Brian Mackey. He's the State House correspondent for NPR Illinois and WUIS-FM in Springfield. We're talking about the budget deal that was reached. I mean, normally we wouldn't give it all that much attention, except that it's the first budget that the governor is expected to sign, and it's the first deal that we've had since the governor's been in office. We've got a question from Ron. Ron, welcome as always to the Sunday Spin.
Yes, good morning. My question is, if with this balanced budget you appear to have some stability, which usually can benefit the incumbent. So I want to ask you, guess, on the political implications for the government. You know, and again, Rick, you pointed out he backed off on some of these other demands, but I think it puts him in a pretty good position. It's going to be pretty hard, you know, for the Democrats to attack him if he can come in with a balanced budget. So thanks, guys.
Sure. Thank you, Ron. Brian, what are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, one imagines that it's better to have passed a budget and be able to have that achievement instead of, you know, having to campaign in crisis, you know, while there's a crisis unfolding in state government. I mean, last time, 3 years ago now, when we didn't have a budget, there were lawsuits unfolding, and we were hearing stories of social service agencies that were shutting down. We saw university enrollments decline because particularly the directional universities like Western and Southern and Eastern really are more dependent on the state for funding. And so it definitely seems like it would be an easier way to campaign on actually having had a budget than not having it.
And not having all of those complaints. But I too think also, and I'd like your thoughts, Brian, on this as well, is that as much as now, you know, he's accepting of that 32%, the revenues from that tax increase, the boogeyman now shifts to the proposal by Democrats and Democratic nominee J.B. Pritzker for a graduated income tax that taxes at higher rates based on the higher incomes that occur. And that because it would have to be done as a constitutional amendment, nobody wants to put tax rates in the state constitution, because it would be done that way, it's kind of an unknown that provides an opening for Rauner and Republicans to attack Democrats.
It does. I mean, they're going to be able to say that, you know, Democrats want to raise your taxes again, which, of course, it doesn't have to be that way. It could be in one of the proposals that a non-party group, but one that has some support from organized labor called the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, they put out some rates. And, in fact, a lot of people in Illinois would see their taxes get lower under their particular plan because, of course, a graduated income tax is as your income levels go up, the more money you earn, those higher income levels are taxed at a higher rate. So you might pay one rate for income below $50,000, then a slightly higher rate for the money you make, you know, if you're fortunate enough to make more than $100,000 a year, all the way on up to, you know, we could have a special rate just for millionaires has been discussed. But the Pritzker campaign has decided, even though it's, you know, has been vocally supporting the concept of this graduated income tax, you're right, it has not decided to put out any specific tax rates or what the details of the plan it would like to see, and that leaves an opening for the governor and Republicans to make it a boogeyman in the campaign. I mean, I'm sure they would, you know, they'll find other things to be boogeyman in the campaign.
Oh, there'll be plenty of those.
Do. But, you know, this one does intrigue me, and I want to mention one of my, I come back to this a lot, but there was a poll from the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University last year that showed pretty overwhelming support for a graduated income tax. Now, this was during the budget impasse, the budget crisis, so maybe things have changed, but even it was well into the 70 percentage points overall favored the graduated income tax. Even among conservatives and Republicans, though, it was greater than 50% support for that. So I've always scratched my head a little bit about, you know, the thought on the governor's team and the Republican side that this is just a sure thing winner. But, you know, that was just one snapshot poll. They may have, I'm sure they have better polling data than I have access to.
As we said earlier, the governor just laid down conditions for this budget that were just make it balanced and don't raise taxes. But it's a budget, like all budgets are, and when you talk about issues of balance here, you know, one of the things I think is very interesting is this expectation of saving $445 million by offering buyouts of pension accrual to individuals, that instead of getting the pension as they normally would, they would accept a lump sum buyout of 60% of that they could go invest on their own. And it was, I guess it was pointed out that some kind of similar program was done in Missouri, and 22% of those eligible took part in it. But Missouri doesn't have the same pension guarantees in its constitution like Illinois does. And that seems like a dartboard kind of number.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of things like that in this budget. I mean, the state is going to sell the Thompson Center in this budget.
Again.
And to get some, yeah. And I was talking to somebody from S&P, the credit rating agency, a few weeks ago, and he said, you know, we have in government, you have recurring revenues, which is like an income tax, so you get that money every year no matter what, and you have things that are called one-time revenues, like in Chicago, you know, selling the parking meters or leasing the parking meters. That's you get one shot at that. And so that the Thompson Center, you would normally say, is a one-time revenue, but it's almost in danger of becoming a recurring revenue if we just say we're going to sell it every year.
It helps plug $270 million if you're, you know, trying to calculate a budget together.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, there are a few things that are speculative like that, and frankly, I'm still going through it. I mean, it was, 1,400 pages? But, you know, the both Democrats and Republicans say that they're pretty proud, and they think that this budget is going to fare better among the sort of good government group analysts and the credit rating agencies and the people who sort of score these things for how legit or kind of full of baloney they are. So
yeah, well, and as everybody was basically saying too, you know, it's better to have a budget than not have one.
Absolutely, and I don't want to sell short the achievement of this negotiated budget. You know, on the one hand, Springfield is not Washington D.C. Even though it has this reputation for political dysfunction, Republicans and Democrats actually work together the overwhelming majority of the time. Most of the legislation, I would venture to say, passes, you know, 100-8 or 110-0 or something like that. This is not, people are not just fighting over every inch and every issue. But in terms of the budget making, I can't remember the last time, maybe during the Blagojevich era when there were some very strange political alliances that shifted around, and certainly during Governor Ryan's tenureship, is the last times that we really had these kind of negotiated bipartisan budgets where just, you know, a handful of people for principle, for whatever reason, voted against it. They just passed by these overwhelming margins. So that is something that is different, and I'm going to be talking to House Republican Leader Jim Durkin on your show today. He said, you know, he hopes that this can be a template for other issues that come before the General Assembly, this sort of spirit of cooperation.
Well, this was indeed the first budget that most Republicans have voted for in quite a long time in the General Assembly.
Or ever, yeah. Senator Karen McConaughey, I was talking to her after the vote, and she said she's been there since 2012, and this is the first time she has ever voted for a budget.
That's Springfield. And that's Brian Mackey, State House correspondent for NPR Illinois and WUIS-FM in Springfield. Brian, thanks so much for getting up with me. I hope you can go get some rest.
Thanks. Good talking to you, Rick. Have a good Sunday.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. Politicians are always looking to liken themselves to winners. Take Governor Bruce Rauner. Last week, his campaign unveiled a digital ad that compared himself to the Cubs after they were bought by the Ricketts family. All it takes, according to Rauner, is 7 years to be a champion.
There's a lot of similarities to what the Cubs have done in recent years and what we need to do in Illinois. You know, the Ricketts took over the Cubs in 2009, and it took them 7 years to build a world champion. Well, we've been turning Illinois around for 3 years. We need 4 more years, 7 years total, and we'll turn around Illinois the same way. More jobs, lower taxes, excellent education, and ending the corruption with term limits. We're going to do this together.
That's Governor Rauner's campaign ad. Of course, the J.B. Pritzker campaign responded with its own digital ad, pointing to what it says are the Cubs' successes and the governor's failures, and their ad is called You're Out. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio in historic Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue is Democratic State Representative Rob Martwick from Chicago. Representative, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks, Rick. It's always fun to be here.
We were talking earlier with Brian Mackey from NPR Illinois about the fact that what I think for the most part would be mundane and normal is actually highly unusual for the fact that you guys were able to come together with Republicans and have a budget deal.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And you know, truth be told, that's the story is that it's unbelievable that we could come together with Republicans. The backside of the story is we always have. Right. I mean, the negotiations that would have produced balanced budgets were going on between Democrats and Republicans in a bipartisan fashion for the last 4 years. There was one guy standing in the way, and that was Governor Rauner. So, you know, the surreal part is that suddenly at the end of session, we started to hear that he was actually willing to sign a budget, and we just, both sides were just shocked, couldn't believe it, you know.
Well, is part of the reason the fact of what happened last year and the fact that a number of Republicans joined with Democrats, crossed over the aisle to support an override of his budget veto, of his tax increase veto, and that those forces could happen again?
Yeah, well, and I mean, I think that's part of it. I'm not really sure, to be honest with you. I really figured his best political play would be to double down on that the tax increase was wrong, not to accept it, because in my mind, when he says that this tax increase was necessary, that this balanced budget is the way to go about things, and that the turnaround agenda items were not necessary, he's basically taking blame for the last 3.5 years. All those people we killed, the $12 billion of additional debt that's put on the backs of taxpayers, that's kind of like he's saying, oops, my bad.
Well, I thought, for example, and I mentioned this to Brian, is, you know, we had heard for months, actually since the end of last legislative session, about the evils of the tax increase and how he's going to work to roll it back and roll it back. And in fact, it was part, a very small bit of a rollback, but it was part of the budget that he presented to the legislature in February.
It was. Yeah.
And so now that seems to undercut that issue in some respects, doesn't it?
It does. And you know, I want to point out, since you bring that up, I want to point out the courage of the 15 Republicans who decided to use math and finance and good government principles and say, we've got to balance this budget, we've got to stop the bleeding. All of them are gone. They're all kicked out. They were all told, no money for you, you're out. And it's a shame, because we're losing the people who were the real adults in the room. And you know, now you've got the almost entire Republican caucus, except for the extreme right wing, the vast majority of them have agreed to this budget that they agreed to last year, basically the same budget. And we're losing those rational, math-based voices, which is really scary for what the next legislative session will bring.
Well, and speaking of math-based, and I note that you decided to provide your colleagues with the Casio calculators. I was actually wondering where mine was. I figured you'd have one for me.
I gave the extras to a school.
So. Good. But about the issue of the graduated tax, and
sure.
Again, I mentioned this to Brian, that because of the inability of to be able to articulate the tax rates,
right,
that provides a potential opening for criticism of it, and everybody points to, well, if there's somebody who had a plan, well, Representative Martwick had a plan, and look what this plan does. And so, and I know you've explained it before, but I'd like to explain it again. So when people hear this criticism that a graduated tax is going to raise your tax,
right,
what yours was more of an experimental adoption and an example.
It was introduced during the budget impasse, and it was designed to show how we could address not just our current problems like the current budget does, and it does a pretty good job of that, but we've got these mounting problems that are going to continue to grow. So I did some research. I asked our Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability. This is a government agency that's nonpartisan. They are number crunchers and economists, and I asked them, over the course of the next 27 years, if we can balance our budgets on the 4.95% tax, and if we live up to our commitments on pensions and education, We are basically running our government at a 6.45% flat tax. If we don't adopt a 6.45% flat tax as of January 1st, and we're clearly not going to do that, then each successive year that we go without it means we need to raise the flat tax even higher to balance the budgets. And they're talking about 7.5%, 8.5% flat tax down the road. The point is that we've got this massive pension debt that we have to get a hold of. And so what I did was I said, mathematically, how do we solve that problem? And I showed that with graduated income tax rates, we could knock off 7 years off of the repayment schedule and save $60 billion on the repayment of the pension debt. We could provide an instant $2.5 billion historic property tax relief, which is what everybody screams about. And we could reduce sales taxes and restore some of our essential spending to higher education and social services. And so the point is when people scream about property tax rates, what I always say is, look, you can have whatever property tax rates you want. The question is, what do you want to do? If you want a tax rate that lowers the taxes on 96% of Illinoisans, well, that's great, but then you will do nothing to address high property taxes, right? So it was just a rebalancing of things. But, you know, I took a lot of criticism over it, but it was math-based. The amazing thing to me is, and that's why I did this little thing where I handed out calculators to my Republican colleagues, was that if you know that we're going to accumulate $225 billion in debt in the next 27 years doing what we did, right? Doing what right. we just passed. And if you have three Federal Reserve economists that say the only way out of your problems is to raise taxes, the only question is how? Let's decide what's the best way to go about it. And what my Republican colleagues were doing was they're saying, we absolutely won't consider a graduated tax. And I said, well, why are you taking options off the table? Use math, use finances, and then we can have a discussion about the best way to go forward. But don't say you won't consider something until you've provided a mathematical solution, something none of them has ever done.
We're speaking with Democratic State Representative Rob Martwick from Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in historic Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. Joining me here in the studio is Democratic State Representative Rob Martwick. We're talking about the recently concluded spring legislative session, concluded with a budget deal, a $38.5 billion budget deal that the governor is expected to sign tomorrow. And before we took the break, Representative, we were talking about the graduated tax plan that you had laid out there, obviously being used as a source of criticism. But inherent in that was you mentioned being able to offer property tax relief. And, you know, we hear people talk about, oh, you know, I've got a plan to cut your property taxes or whatever. Talk about it. We don't see necessarily any plans. And given that the bulk of the property tax bill is for schools, local schools, then you see like a proposal that the governor had in his original budget in February that would shift pension costs over to local school districts. How does that going to reduce your property taxes? There seems to be some incongruity in a lot of this conversation.
Yeah, there is, and we just passed a provision that reduces what we call pension spiking, which is the last salary increases that you can get in your last years. And this used to be a popular tool to really boost somebody's pension, is given these massive pay increases in the last few years of their contract. So we put in a cap at 6%. Now we just lowered that to 3%, meaning that you can only get a 3% salary increase per year in the last 4 years of your contract, so they keep you from spiking. But here's the problem, right? If a union goes in and negotiates a 4.5% pay raise, well, that now shifts the burden. Anything over 3%, the local government has to pick up. So your school district will have to pick up those increases. They will have to pick up the pension cost of those increases, and that will be a burden on the local school district. So, you know, providing property tax relief has to be more than just a wish. It has to be a plan, and the only plan you can do that with is money. So, with the school funding reform, we are putting money in that local school districts can take out, but it's small. It's $50 million a year. The plan that I had proposed put $2.5 billion per year into property tax reduction. So it would have been historic. But again, you know, you can't just wish that. You have to find it from somewhere else. And the way I paid for that was progressive tax rates. And mine were, I just used the ones from Wisconsin, which are probably the most flat and moderate of all the progressive taxes because they start at 4 and end at 7.65, unlike Oregon, which starts at 1 and ends at 11.
We've got a call from Tom. Tom, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Morning, gentlemen. You were referencing solutions for the economy by indicating three individuals said, well, you know, the only way you can get out of this is to raise taxes. But can we not also cut spending to meet our budget? Or if we continue the same way, we'll be $227 billion in the hole. Maybe if we cut some spending, we wouldn't be that far in the hole.
All right, Tom, thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. That's a good question. And I think anytime you've got financial crises, I think that what we need to do is we need to definitely look at ways to cut spending. Last year, the governor in his budget proposal proposed about $2 billion in spending. And in the final budget that we passed over his veto, there was closer to $3 billion in spending. So we cut more than $1 billion more than the governor. We've also made successive cuts to almost every line you can find in the government, and including administration. Our administrative costs are so low. They're lower than on a per capita basis than any other state. And so we've made these cuts, huge cuts to higher education. We now fund higher education 50% less than we did a decade ago. So there's no doubt we should always look towards cuts, but the idea that we can cut our way out of this, the problem is we've done all of the cuts with, you know, and not all of the cuts. You can always find a little bit more, but we've really picked the low-hanging fruit off the tree. It's going to be a challenge. We should keep looking for it, but it's going to be a challenge. One of the things that I'm happy about is, and you talked about it a little bit on the last segment, is I think we've found some creative ways to save some money on pensions. It's not going to solve our pension problem, but I believe it'll start to nibble around the edges and make that repayment of that debt more manageable.
Could you explain this, the pension buyout provision?
Sure.
That was inserted into this?
Yeah, there's two buyout provisions. One is a proposal that, both of these really I've worked on in a very bipartisan fashion with a friend of mine, Mark Batnick, who's a Republican legislator from Plainfield. So his portion of it was the buyout of vested inactives. These are people who have worked long enough in government to vest in a pension but have long since left and are working in the private sector and are no longer accruing. So they're vested, but what they will receive will be a relatively small pension in terms of what they would get monthly out of it. So what we've offered them is to sell their pension benefit back to us will give them 60 cents on the dollar, so they get the money up front of the value of that, a lump sum buyout. As you mentioned, Missouri did this and got about a 22% pickup on it. It's yet to be seen what we will get on it. I get that there are some concerns. I cautioned the budgeteers and the administration to be conservative, but they said this is the guidance that we have. We're going to use that as our estimate. The second one, which was my proposal, which was to offer to retirees at the time that they retire the ability to sell a portion of their COLA so they could accept a lower COLA in exchange for cash up front. So right now, say for instance, a teacher, the average teacher would walk in and get a 3% compounding COLA every year on their benefit, their retirement annuity. In mind, they would walk in and they would agree to, optionally, they don't have to take it. If they want to keep their COLA, 3% compounding COLA, they can. But they can opt into a lower 1.5% simple COLA. And then we calculate out the difference of the value between those, a 3% compounding and a 1.5% simple, and they would get a check up front. That check is about $120,000. But everyone who does it improves the funded liability of the system, especially, and I love this, because we're doing a bonding complement to pay for this, so we're not using system assets. So everyone who takes this really dramatically starts to improve the funded liability of the pension systems and should save us money. Now, they estimated $380 billion in savings in the first year.
$380 million
in savings in the first year. Whether or not that will come to fruition or not, I don't know. But there are many. See, with this, because anyone who takes one of these because of the fact that we're getting it at a discount, my plan is to come back next year and offer more options. How about a 3% simple? How about selling a portion of your annuity? So if you're getting a $100,000 annuity, how about you sell $30,000 of your annuity? So let's find something that works for these people, because anyone who takes one of these deals, the more participation, the more the savings.
Well, and as we know from the courts, we're basically hamstrung.
Yes. This is constitutional because it's permissible and it's optional. It's not a lot of the pie-in-the-sky unconstitutional ideas that have been floated around lately. It's something that everyone agrees will work, is constitutional, doesn't harm anybody, and in fact may be a really a great benefit for some of the people who opt into it.
Yeah, because part of a lot of talk about this consideration model type thing of alternative benefits,
yeah.
But everybody that I've talked to that understands that model says, well, but one of the options has to be you don't do anything.
Yes, and we actually passed that last year. We actually passed the Cullerton model with the option that you could keep what you've got, because that makes it valid, but it was never implemented.
Right. Well, and I guess, do you, the last couple of seconds here we've got, in this kumbaya moment that we've had, to basically end when everybody got on I-55 and drove home, because now we start the campaign season?
Yeah, you know, it doesn't end, and that's one of the things that I'm happy to be here to talk to you about. There's no doubt it's a great step. We need to show stability, but we can't take our eye off the ball. We've got mounting problems that we need to address, and we need to find answers to them so we don't hamstring the next generation. It's coming fast.
It's coming fast, and these are big debts.
Yeah, they're huge, and we've got to get our head around them. We have to have a mathematical financial plan to pay them off, otherwise they will consume us. Imagine if we have to go to 8.5% flat tax. If you think people are fleeing the state now, try and propose that one.
That's Democratic State Representative Rob Martwick, Democrat from Chicago. Representative, thank you as always for
joining
me.
Thanks so much. I appreciate being here one last time.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. President angered allies, including Canada, for imposing sharp tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. The move also angered Republican congressmen from major manufacturing areas. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau responded with a statement in which he said he didn't blame the American people. Here's Justin Trudeau.
He was, and we are all so grateful that the president is thinking of us in this way. But it's been such a long road for us, and we've been so disappointed so many times before, you know, by the court twice, by the president of our own party.
That was the wrong clip, of course. I'm sorry about that. That was Patty Blagojevich, because we can't have enough Patty Blagojevich here in our world these days. Joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Illinois House Republican Leader Jim Durkin from Western Springs. Leader Durkin, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Glad to be here.
Sorry to give you that lead-in with Patty Blagojevich, but interesting times that we live in these days.
Oh, boy, aren't they?
And you were one of the lead prosecutors, as it were, in the impeachment.
That's correct.
I don't want to go there.
Why not? Everybody else has.
Well, I don't. I mean, your thoughts were that he should not get any commutation.
No, absolutely not. You know what? We have a court system in place. You may not be happy with the verdict or the sentence, but we have multiple layers of appeals between the appellate court, the U.S. Supreme Court, back down to the circuit court for habeas petitions. There are so many ways in which an aggrieved defendant can challenge their conviction and sentence, and he has lost at every stage. We need to respect the system.
Twice before the Supreme Court of the United States.
I can't even count it, but we need to respect the system, and I hope that the president does not commute the sentence. I think it sends a wrong message about what our federal government and the president believe about corruption. And I was caught off guard the other day when I heard those comments. So, but this case has been thoroughly vetted by so many different courts, and I really hope that, again, the president will walk back those his thoughts and ensure that the court systems will be, no one's going to challenge their integrity when we need to have some separation of powers. But I think that this goes too far.
As you said, you were caught off guard when you were asked about this the other day, because there were other things going on in Springfield then. Like trying to get a budget through, and which, as I've been saying throughout the morning, it's kind of, in a normal situation, a budget is certainly an achievement, but it's an expected achievement. And this was, in some respects, an unexpected achievement.
Yes, I had a feeling within about a week and a half out that this was for real, but I was very guarded with my, I wouldn't say optimism, but I thought that we can conclude with a negotiated budget within the time in which we are supposed to get this stuff done at the end of May. History has shown over the past few years that we shouldn't be so optimistic. So it was a lot
when you
of...
Said, when you said guarded, what do you mean? You didn't... Something might slip out.
Absolutely. There's a poison pill that is thrown in at the end. And, you know, the relationship between the governor and the speaker, it's not good. And it's the legislature who drives the budget. We're the ones that craft it. We're the ones who present it to the governor. And the speaker, you know, he can be very creative at times. And crafty also.
That's an interesting use of terms there. But
guarded.
Well, but this seemed to be also, I think, a reflection that nobody wanted to go through the impasse.
Absolutely. All of us were drained. Our constituents are just so sick and tired of the bickering, the fighting. Even the staunches of conservatives that I know in my neighborhood are like, will you guys just please get this done? Put your partisan politics aside. And, you know, you have plenty of time over the summer and the fall to go at each other, but don't let the state go on this road anymore. And I will say that what drove this budget was the pressure within the caucuses, the rank and file members who are not going to put up with another impasse. And I've heard that once. I heard it, you know, 50 times. I'm one of 51, so I heard it 50 times. And I think that that's what motivated the speaker and the president to engage Republicans, truly engage us in an open manner for the first time in a long time.
Well, and this was the first time that Republicans voted for a budget in a long time.
I can't recall the last time I voted for a budget. It may have been back under George Ryan.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
It
of
was,
back
yeah,
then.
Yeah. So I think we got over 90 votes in the House, and I just showed you how.
Things can get done.
Can get done, but I think people were just starving for that opportunity to vote for a budget and say, look, it's not perfect. But you know what? We actually negotiated something. It's a compromise. It's not a bad thing. It's not a dirty word. But we compromised where nobody gets everything they want, but you know what? Everybody gets something. And the state's going to operate, and we're going to continue on for a full year without having the calamity or the uncertainty with institutions and people who rely upon the state.
You've heard some critics, though, that, oh, well, those lawmakers, they shouldn't be patting themselves on the back for this, that there's...
Who's patting themselves on the back? I'm not. I think that we did our job for the first time. I think it's good that we actually got this done. It's a framework for us. If the Democrats want to engage us on major issues down the road, there's a way to do it. We did this twice in the last year. We did it with education funding reform last summer, and we did it with the budget this year. I'm not gloating. I don't, you know, what we did is what our constituents expect us to do, and nothing more. So I don't think that we should be having the USC marching band shouldn't be coming in and giving us a big parade. This is what our responsibilities are every year we walk into that building. We did it. We got it done. But we can't allow the past to continue and to infiltrate our thinking when we get into the month of May.
Do you truly think that this does, in some respects, signal some kind of a new change in dynamics in the General Assembly?
Oh, I think so. I think what I've, like I said earlier, a lot of this was driven by the rank and file members who have grown frustrated, with the process or their lack of input, or just maybe the personalities who got into the way of crafting a budget. So I will say that this is a new era in Springfield, that the powers to be may have lost a little bit of their power because their members were pushing them and saying, you better get this done, otherwise there'll be consequences.
And it, along with that, it would seem, and I know I'm not asking you to speak for the governor, but there was that realization on the second floor as well.
I think so, too. And I know that the, at least from my perspective, that the governor could have been in a very difficult situation. But the governor was, if he did not walk out of, if we didn't walk out of Springfield with presenting him a budget that was within his very, I would say, modest request. No new taxes, balanced. And we did that. And but the governor going into the summer without having a, you know, a budget that's been negotiated, I don't think anybody wins. It's going to be a public, going to say, a pox on that whole building.
And I was going to say, I don't know that you could parse it into partisanship at that point. It's just everybody, it would just be throw everybody
I thought through so many scenarios in the beginning of May if this was going to fall apart, of who was going to wear the collar for it. And at the end of the day, all of us would. And we're walking into an election season. You have to be mindful of that. But we're better off as a state having not having to worry about this. You know, we'll it'll be addressed this week by the governor, and then we can get into the fun stuff of campaigns.
Well, I want to ask you just what you just said. It's going to be addressed by the governor supposedly tomorrow. There's an event tomorrow morning. The governor in his statement said he would act quickly. But are we assured that he's going to sign this in its entirety?
The governor will sign the budget bill and the budget implementation bill. There's two bills that are
the BIMP bill is known in Springfield. The lovely BIMP.
He will sign both.
Okay, so we have that assurance.
Yes,
we're speaking with Illinois House Republican Leader Jim Durkin from Western Springs. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. Joining me here in the studio is Illinois House Republican Leader Jim Durkin. We're talking about the legislative session adjournment on time, the fact that we got a budget agreement on time, and just kind of a general change in atmosphere. In my Sunday story, I noted that it takes, it only in Illinois politics would it take a contentious election year to bring at least a dose of normalcy to state government.
Well,
there's something ironic in that.
You took the words right out of my mouth, Rick. Yeah, of course. You know, we're, a lot of people are going to be, some of them have real challenges in November, other ones don't have real challenges, but, you know, I don't think that anybody should take their seat for granted. No one expected that Donald Trump would have won 2 years ago. This is a very, very fickle electorate and
volatile,
fickle, you name it. So anything can happen next November. And I've warned my members, particularly those I've been saying, particularly the ones who think that they've got an easy election next November, get out there quick and be everywhere in your district. Don't take anything for granted because things can change quickly and you can be out of a job.
And sometimes not even by your own doing.
Exactly. There's going to be a national, this is going to be a combination of where the people of Illinois are at with Springfield, and I think 50 other, that's half of it. The other half is going to be what's happening in Washington, which is going to trickle down to the state level.
So as state legislators, how do you, as Republican state legislators, how do you address maybe concerns on the national level?
You know, that's interesting. It depends on the region.
It certainly does.
In downstate Illinois, I would say from particularly south of Bloomington, central Illinois, it's a very strong Donald Trump area.
South of I-80.
Maybe even further north. Maybe even that far north. Far north, yeah. He has a strong following. I think his different approach towards government, his kind of like, I'm against the machine.
I'm against everything.
I'm against everything, and you know what? The DOJ and the FBI are running amok, and I'm going to start commuting sentences. I'm going to start pardoning people as my way of showing that, you know what, my disdain for that institution. I think that in the suburbs, it's a different perspective. I live in the suburbs, and I don't think that Donald Trump's numbers are very strong in Western Springs or LaGrange, where in my area. But you've got to be able to finesse the national and the state issues But at the end of the day, everything's local. That's what I think. I've been told that from day one, that all politics are local. So, you know, be present, and you got to be able to get out there and explain exactly what you did.
Well, and speaking of this kind of regionalism, one of the things that I thought that helped move a budget agreement was the fact that for downstate legislators, a lot of Republicans that have state institutions in their districts or state workers that work at these institutions, higher ed, prison, whatever, that was a kind of a stabilizing factor too.
That was an easier sell. Those members in downstate Illinois, those who do have those corrections, they have two or three penitentiaries in their district and other, you know, human service parts of Department of Human
Public
Services,
Health.
Public Health. Of course, those are their neighbors, and there's a great amount of those in those areas. Those state is probably the largest employer in a lot of those
right.
counties in those regions. So, those were the easy sells. I didn't think we'd hit 90 votes, but as we started getting close to the day of the vote, we started talking more and more to our members about this is what, in our perspective, it's balanced. We haven't done that in a long time. It is not relying upon new taxes, and that's all they wanted to hear. But that's what the governor set out about 2 months ago when he sent a letter to the four leaders. He said, I want a balanced budget with no new taxes. That's it. No other conditions.
Now, one of the things I raised in speaking to Brian Mackey from Public Radio early this morning was about that the governor, has, of course, has been very critical of that tax increase that was approved a year ago. But now that's built in and baked into the budget. And in my Sunday story, I kind of think that the graduated income tax proposal that's backed by Democrats is now the new boogeyman, because you can't. Well, the candidates, J.B. Pritzker, other Democrats, won't say what the rates should be. And well, but it's also a constitutional amendment. You don't want to enshrine rates in a constitution.
Well, they should give us at least an idea of what state that they are looking to match. Now, I was at the hearing at the Blahnik Building a month and a half ago, and I asked the Democrat majority leader specifically about what the rates that she would envision, what are the right rates for Illinois under her perspective. No one wants to talk about it. J.B. Pritzker doesn't want to talk about it. But just remember, J.B. Pritzker said we need to raise the current level before we even get to the change in the Constitution. So the Democrats raised taxes last year on families and also businesses. J.B. Pritzker, the billionaire, wants to raise taxes again while he's working on changing the Constitution, and then having some type of what he calls a progressive tax system. But one state, we've mentioned a number of states that are very similar to Illinois, and under those states' system of their progressive tax, the middle class does not work out well. Yes, the higher bracket, higher earners do get taxed significantly, but people who are making anywhere from $50,000 to $80,000 a year are paying up to 7 or 8%. So there's nothing fair about that.
Well, but what, though, if everybody, as I even spoke with Representative Martwick earlier, and, of course, he had proposed kind of a end-all, be-all proposal, which you Republicans take great delight in poking at.
Not me.
Well, but in that proposal, though, was an example of how this could also provide a great deal of property tax relief, which is something that everybody in the state wants to see.
Well, we can do property tax relief independent of that. We've been pushing, myself, the governor, and also Republicans have been pushing for the past 3 years, property tax relief. The House passes their version. The Senate passes their version. Nothing becomes law. Nothing gets sent to the governor. But, you know, everybody says that I passed property tax relief. So it's just part of the Springfield smoke and mirrors game.
But for true property tax relief, though, given that the bulk of the money and property taxes are being spent on schools, you have to, I mean, there would have to be a cost shift. There would have to be a burden shift.
There would be, but
I mean, and ideally, that's kind of what the new education funding formula eventually is supposed to help offset.
It is. It's supposed to offset, but if we continue down this road without giving at least an option to local taxpayers to be able to determine their fate with their property taxes, we're going to continue with this exodus out of the state. Right now, it's, you know, they're paying a lot in their individual taxes, but their property tax bill is just getting worse. And I can tell you that. I look at my property tax bills, and I just got my appeal was just rejected by the county. So
You don't know what guy?
No, absolutely not. That's the last thing I'm going to do is call a guy. No, it won't happen.
But I mean, I think we are at that point where it's the property tax system is just so well. Besides the flaws that have been outlined in Cook County, but just the fairness of, as I've said for a long time, the fairness of relying on a 17th century form of wealth, agrarian wealth, to as a funding mechanism. I just tend to think our whole taxation system is not modernized with the time.
No, it hasn't been. It's mainly driven by politics of Springfield and also out of City Hall and the county building. And you dip your toe into that water, and you determine whether or not
whether your toe still can come out of it.
Yes, exactly. But it can't be a third rail, because every time you jump into it, there's no one is satisfied, and it just brings out the worst in people. So I'm hopeful that I'm reelected, and that we can address this matter with Governor Rauner in his second term, and actually provide a realistic form of property tax relief, not the nonsense that we've seen over the years. But you know what? I think it's got to be citizen driven. I think it's important that there'll be referendum questions that'll be placed that are realistic. If the citizens of Illinois want property tax relief, we want to give them that ability to do it. And to me, that's the way you do it. It's like letting the local property taxpayers make a decision whether or not they need to cut from their schools, their park district, their libraries. And to me, that's citizen empowerment, and that's what good government's about.
And now the campaign goes on.
Correct. Yes. That's what I understand. But you know what? That's fine. I'd rather be involved with the campaign as opposed to my time in Springfield, where I often think of myself as a unlicensed psychiatrist, usually during the month of May.
I can only imagine. That's Illinois House Republican leader Jim Durkin from Western Springs.